3 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. O. Kendall White, Jr., reading the paper Cultural Boundaries, the Mormon Intellectual, the Church, and the Community. Kendall White is a professor of sociology and anthropology at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. He's the author of Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, A Crisis Theology. Responding to his paper is Dr. David Knowlton, who's assistant professor of anthropology at Brigham Young University. Dr. White.
Boundaries delineating the degree of inclusion and exclusion from both institutional and cultural Mormonism are defined, negotiated, and redefined through the interaction of the church, community, and its intellectuals. This paper, based primarily on personal experience, examines the relationship between Mormon social organization and intellectual life. I will argue that my own experience made it impossible for me to be included within the church, which remains true today. But further delineation between the Mormon church and the Mormon community, fostered primarily by intellectuals, enables me to conceive of myself as a cultural Mormon, should I wish to do so, providing at the same time a social context in which I can feel at home. This was not always so, and one of my purposes is to discuss the renegotiation of these boundaries, arguing that a distinction between the Mormon church and the Mormon community is not only analytically useful, but is increasingly becoming a pronounced feature of social reality in Mormondom. At this point, I will describe 2 personal encounters with Mormon ecclesiastical authority in which the boundaries limiting intellectual diversity became clearly apparent to me. Both followed a successful Mormon mission and occurred as I attended college. Since I had hoped to become a teacher in the LDS educational system in an institute of religion, I emphasized religion and philosophy in my studies at the University of Utah. Well integrated into both the church and the university, I was excited about my new religious and intellectual life. My relatively recent discovery of a liberal Mormon subculture made this a period of both expanding intellectual horizons and intense identification with Mormonism.
The first experience occurred in priesthood meeting. During a New Testament lesson, I asked the instructor and fellow elders how they interpreted Jesus' admonition to the rich man to sell all that he had and to give it to the poor. Was this text to be understood literally? Did it simply mean that we ought to be concerned about the poor? Or did it apply only to the rich man? My attempt to obtain the wisdom of others in formulating my own moral position came to an abrupt halt when a visiting stake high councilman insisted that, quote, if the Lord wanted us to sell all that we have and give it to the church, then President Henry D. Moyle, whom he identified as a millionaire, would have done so. My apparent impropriety in suggesting that the issue was the poor, not the church, that if the two were synonymous when Jesus spoke, they certainly were not today, and my distraction of the instructor by preventing him from easily moving to his following point led the high councilman to stop the discussion, assuming that this was simply an abortive attempt to obtain insight about our obligations toward the poor. I left priesthood meeting disappointed, but not surprised. I certainly expected nothing beyond what had occurred that Sunday. My brother and I were late for priesthood meeting the following Sunday. As we stood at the door deciding whether to enter or wait until Sunday school, we noticed a different rhythm from typical Mormon speech. In fact, someone was reading a prepared text. Upon hearing my name, we joined our brethren. The Quorum president read about dissent during the previous meeting, informing us that delving into the mysteries was unacceptable and sustaining the authorities of the church essential. I stated that though my question remained unanswered, I never had any intention of derailing the instructor's lesson, but I was perplexed about the question of sustaining the authorities of the church. What had I said or asked that implied failure to sustain church authorities? What did sustaining church authorities entail? Did it require uncritical obedience, acquiescence to hierarchy, or did it permit loyal opposition? Putting our academic studies on hold, two of my brothers and I undertook an aggressive perusal of Mormon history and theology on the matter of sustaining church authorities. We did derail the course of priesthood lessons for the next 3 weeks, and the quorum was divided over the meaning of sustaining church authorities. I asked the instructor, a childhood friend, to allow me to join him should he be called in by the bishop or stake president. But he adroitly moved the priesthood sessions back on course as we left this issue behind. 6 weeks had passed, and we assumed the debate, if not resolved, had been abandoned. Then, with six stake high councilmen gracing our meeting, I assumed that the quorum presidency was being reorganized. However, the lesson ended 10 minutes early, and the quorum president turned the meeting over to a high councilman, who, upon lecturing us about the evils of dissent, led the instructor from the room to the stake president's office. My attempt to join him failed, and he was removed from his position after being asked if he sustained the general authorities or, like Kendall, believed them to be in a state of apostasy. The second experience transpired a year later. I was teaching a college-age Sunday school class. Again, the New Testament was the subject, and the manual carefully framed the discussions and questions. Since it castigated biblical scholars, higher and lower critics, I asked class members if they were aware of biblical criticism. None of them had heard of either higher or lower criticism, but everyone chose to spend the next 4 weeks examining examples of each: the historical responses of Mormon authorities, and the implications of such biblical scholarship for the Mormon posture toward the Bible. I was asked by class members to identify my own views at the conclusion of our inquiry. Upon entering the room for the final session, I found 12 to 15 people instead of the normal 3 to 6. Four or five of the new faces were people whom I did not recall having ever seen before, and some of the others were associated with the stake Sunday school board. Initially, I chose not to discuss my views, since understanding them depended upon the previous 4 weeks, but I found myself nonetheless doing so. A class that normally lasted 30 to 40 minutes continued for a couple of hours, with several people testifying to the truthfulness of the gospel and demanding that I do the same. When the session ended, a member of the Sunday school board escorted me to the stake president's office, where his first counselor offered me a position on the stake board with the responsibility of visiting other classes to guarantee that teachers had strong testimonies of the gospel. I was to ensure that others possessed the very quality I presumably lacked. Indicating that I wanted to continue teaching the class, they assigned a newly returned missionary to accompany me, and 3 weeks later concluded that only one teacher was really necessary. That was the last position I held in the church. Two criteria for ensuring institutional loyalty and maintaining social control emerge from these experiences: the necessity of sustaining the authorities of the church and the requirement for a personal testimony of the truthfulness of the restored gospel. Since an authentic testimony recognizes the church as the institutional guardian of religious doctrine and acknowledges its sacramental role, a testimony reproduces the hierarchical structure of the church in the consciousness of adherents and reinforces the principle of sustaining authorities. In fact, a typical testimony acknowledges the president of the church as prophet, seer, and revelator, and identifies Mormon apostles with the same authority, power, and position attributed to their ancient counterparts. Consequently, a testimony of the gospel and the principle of sustaining authorities of the church combined to enhance institutional control and to ensure personal loyalty. Failure to sustain church authorities can be costly. Uncomfortable questions not only imply that one does not sustain church leaders and thereby lead to censure, but sustaining church authorities is required for an individual to enter the Mormon temple, receive his or her personal endowments, form an eternal family, advance in the priesthood, or hold ecclesiastical office. Virtually all of the cases with which I'm familiar, where individuals have appeared before church courts for political dissent or expressing controversial ideas, include formal charges of failure to sustain church authorities. Moreover, the ambiguity characterizing the sustaining principle often is used by local officials to strengthen institutional control. My own arguments in priesthood meeting for Mormonism's ideal polity as either a theocratic democracy or a democratic theocracy, depending upon which principle is granted higher priority, fell on deaf ears as stake and ward officials insisted on purely autocratic solutions. Preoccupied with immediate concerns, including the ritualistic flow of the lesson manual, and unaware of Mormon history, they dismissed implications of Mormon examples of democratic applications of the sustaining principle and insisted that no discussions of this matter nor disagreement with church officials on others would be tolerated in the future. Having equated disagreement with disloyalty, they reaffirm Mormonism's most extreme reading of the sustaining principle and its relationship to intellectual dissent, i.e., the 1945 Ward Teacher's message asserting that when our leaders speak, the thinking has been done. If sustaining the authorities is a mechanism of institutional control, then a personal testimony may be conceptualized as a means of cognitive control. As an affirmation of basic Mormon assumptions and governing principles, the personal testimony links the self to the institution by locating the individual within the institutional structure, proclaiming that one knows that God exists, that Jesus is the Christ, that Joseph Smith was the prophet through whom the gospel was restored, and that the current president of the church is the prophet, seer, and revelator who governs with 12 apostles called by God, is a personal, typically public, confession of one's subordination to church hierarchy. Having borne, if I might be permitted a little Utahnese, such a testimony, the individual is placed in a precarious position. He has privileged the judgment of church officials over his own, and his testimony may come back to haunt him should he confront church authority. It was this confession that was required of me when I was removed from teaching the Sunday school class. Had I acknowledged the superior judgment of church officials, including perhaps the author of the lesson manual, over that of higher and lower critics of the New Testament, then I could have retained my position. In fact, one of the stake board members reassured me that my testimony was required to prevent others in the class from drawing inappropriate conclusions based on my limited presentation of biblical scholarship. Clearly, the issue was not the limited presentation, but the fact that I bore no testimony to dilute or negate implications of biblical criticism. While employing language of the intellect, the testimony is a confession of faith. Its purpose, at least in this context, is to negate or deny knowledge, to put an end to discussion, and to limit intellectual curiosity. It clearly takes precedence over knowledge. as a ritual conclusion to my unacceptable departure from the manual and inappropriate discussion of biblical criticism, my testimony would have provided closure by reassuring fellow class members that biblical scholars constituted no threat to our privileged knowledge. Without that testimony, however, ambiguity reigned, and I could not be permitted to teach the class. These two encounters with the boundaries of institutional Mormonism, combined with my rejection of the church's racial policy, its sexual morality, especially the pronatalism, economic values, typical political positions in theology, convinced me that I did not belong. I should state also that I'm talking about the period of the mid-1960s as the events that I'm describing here. No longer could I consent to two fundamental principles of the church. I could neither sustain church authorities nor claim a testimony of the restored gospel, which precluded authentic participation at the institutional level. With the exception of occasional correspondence with Mormon officials, a lingering intellectual and political interest in Mormon affairs, and some nostalgic musings, the church and I parted company, each going separate ways, with neither, I suspect, having any serious regrets. Institutional Mormonism, the formally organized church, is not the Mormon community. The latter, which has expanded considerably since my priesthood and Sunday school days in the mid-60s, now embodies a wide range of unofficial organizations sponsoring Mormon cultural and intellectual life. The liberal Mormon subculture, which I discovered during my youth, was a loosely organized network of underground discussion groups that circulated papers and debated ideas. I still recall my elation upon learning about the anticipated publication of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and our subsequent speculation regarding its chances for success. Today, as Dialogue approaches its 30th anniversary, it shares the spotlight with Sunstone, the Journal of Mormon History, Exponent 2, and other publications. During the past year, an invitation arrived to subscribe to a new Mormon journal, the Wasatch Review International, devoted exclusively to Mormon literary pursuits. Moreover, a number of Mormon academic associations sponsor annual symposia devoted to Mormon theology, history, literature, practice, and society. While the Mormon History Association increasingly enjoys the respect of other American historians, the Society for the Sociological Study of Mormon Life recently established ties with the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, one of the major social scientific associations devoted to the study of religion, enabling co-sponsored sessions devoted to the analysis of Mormonism at the latter's annual meetings. Yet these associations primarily reach narrow academic audiences. Certainly the most popular among Latter-day Saints, and apparently the most threatening to ecclesiastical officials, at least currently, are the Sunstone Symposia, occurring several times a year and held at various locations throughout the country. They attract thousands of people interested in Mormonism. Despite ecclesiastical investigations and efforts to intimidate participants in 1990, an official warning to church members to avoid such symposia in 1991, and the disclosure of a special committee that maintains dossiers on dissenting intellectuals in 1992, participation levels at Sunstone Conference remain high, and of course I'm not in a position to anticipate what the developments for 1993 will be, but we'll know soon. Even the recent controversy surrounding academic freedom at Brigham Young University and the failure of the university to renew the contracts of Professor Cecilia Farr and David Knowlton as disturbing as these events may be, do not portend the demise of Mormon intellectual life. In fact, they can be interpreted as evidence of a vibrant intellectual subculture among contemporary Mormons. Obviously, I'm arguing that the Mormon community is not coterminous with the Mormon church. The community is larger than the church, and its boundaries are expanding. While the community includes the church, it is my contention that the church has lost control of the community and no longer can dictate or define Mormon culture. That the church remains the most powerful force within the Mormon community may be beyond dispute, but I believe it lacks the power, though perhaps not the will, to set the agenda and define the parameters of Mormon intellectual life. For today, the Mormon community attracts a diverse population of intellectuals, is increasingly well-organized, and may enjoy significant popular support. Discussion groups like those prevalent during the earlier times still exist, but unlike the past, their participants enjoy access to a fine array of publications and symposia to aid in their intellectual quest. It is this context that empowers intellectuals to become an increasingly important force in shaping Mormon culture and defining Mormon community. Recent responses of Mormon officials to the Sunstone Symposia and attempts to intimidate participating intellectuals are, in my judgment, a concerted effort to reestablish the church's hegemony over the Mormon community, while any ensuing confrontation between the church, between church authorities and Mormon intellectuals is likely to cause considerable personal suffering and institutional embarrassment, as illustrated by recent events, it is too late for church authorities to regain control over Mormon intellectual life and thereby limit the boundaries of the Mormon community to the Mormon church. Mormon intellectuals simply enjoy too much autonomy, are too well organized, and Mormon ecclesiastical officials are too preoccupied with the church's image and an ongoing quest for respectability to assume the cost of such a confrontation. I might have to retract that, but those were sentiments at the moment of writing. The emergence of a robust Mormon community with considerable autonomy poses important implications for the recent debate over Mormon ethnicity and the relationship of people like me to Mormonism. For it is the community, not the institution, that provides the basis for defining individuals as people. Most Mormon history finds the church and the community largely coterminous, with the with institutional affiliation providing the foundation for the Mormon social order and the convert's new Mormon identity. This new identity, as the argument for a Mormon ethnicity presupposes, assume precedence over previous national and racial identities as being Mormon became more the most salient feature in the self-definition of the individual. European converts sang songs defining their native lands as Babylon as they set out to create Zion in the tops of the mountains. No collective referent was to be more significant in defining the self than one's new identity as Mormon. As long as the church and the community were coterminous, Mormon ethnicity depended upon institutional participation. Mario DePillis's recent article, The Persistence of Mormon Community into the 1990s, is a brilliant analysis of Mormon community at the institutional level, based on similar premises to the above argument regarding Mormon ethnicity, though he appears in footnotes to reject the idea of Mormon ethnicity. But let me restate my sentence here. Based on similar premises to the above argument regarding Mormon ethnicity, DePillis argues that during the 19th century, Mormon community, both as a sense of peoplehood and primary social relations, depended upon location or place. The doctrine of the gathering required the migration of converts from their native lands to Zion, a specific place, to build a holy city in preparation for Jesus' return. Boundaries separating the saints from others define both Mormon identity and community. With their reentry into the American mainstream during the 20th century, the Mormons abandoned the gathering and redefined Zion as a state of mind or the pure in heart. With converts remaining in their native lands, the church entered an era of expansive growth. However, the internationalization of Mormonism posed new problems. How could a burgeoning bureaucracy maintain the community and identity characteristic of 19th century Mormonism? The answer for DePillis is found in the social organization of the Mormon ward. As the local congregation, a ward's geographical boundaries, unlike the Catholic parish, are determined by the size of the congregation and the presence of sufficient talent to perform the requisite task. As wards grow to points where face-to-face interaction becomes difficult, or when they shrink to points where they cannot sustain various church programs, they divide into two wards, or two wards merge into one, requiring the redefining of geographical boundaries. Instead of geography defining the size of the congregation, the size of the congregation defines geographical boundaries. Consequently, Mormonism preserves community by maintaining that critical mass necessary for a ward to function while limiting its size to facilitate primary social relations. As Mormonism approaches the 21st century, this system of wards enables the church to export Mormon identity and maintain community in diverse societies throughout the world. Though I will resist the temptation to comment on DePillis' observations about Mormon ethnicity and the prospects for a multicultural Mormonism, I think that he has defined Mormon community too narrowly. Identifying it with institutional Mormonism, he neglects those sources of Mormon culture emerging outside of the church and their role in creating a broader Mormon community. Today, the church and the community are not synonymous. Consequently, people may define themselves as Mormon without participation in institutional Mormonism. It is possible for someone like me, who cannot be an active participant within the church, to define myself, should I desire, as a cultural Mormon. Since I'm not theologically Mormon, nor willing to abide by Mormon religious practice, I cannot participate in institutional Mormonism. Because of my theological position, I would confront sharper institutional boundaries today than I did during the 1960s. For I'm an agnostic with theistic or atheistic propensities, depending perhaps on what I had for breakfast, counts in the morning newspaper, or the fear or fear of the election of another Republican presidency. So I would not expect institutional Mormonism to welcome me within its fold. While I may be critical of specific boundaries established by the church, I recognize that the vitality of institutions depends, at least to some extent, on their delineation of boundaries. The Mormon Church cannot define its boundaries loosely enough to incorporate people like me and remain the Mormon Church, nor would I expect it to do so. I do feel at home, on the other hand, within the Mormon community. This membership requires neither a testimony of the restored gospel nor that I sustain any general authorities of the church. Indeed, it does not even demand that I be a theist. In fact, I'm not sure that it requires that I be LDS. For the Mormon intellectual community has introduced me to active participants who've been excommunicated from the church, are LDS scholars, and some non-Mormon Mormon buffs who seem to feel as much at home as active participants from Brigham Young University and the Mormon intelligentsia. Today, the boundaries of the Mormon community are fluid, amorphous, and consequently terrifying to those who control institutional Mormonism. I've proposed the distinction between institutional Mormonism and the Mormon community for both descriptive and analytical purposes. While institutional Mormonism refers to the formal organization of the church, the Mormon community constitutes a much broader base of unofficial organizations and distinctively Mormon subcultures. These reflect the interest of Mormons with diverse institutional bonds. My brief description of the Mormon community, with boundaries defined by Mormonism's intellectual subculture, illustrates the contrast between institutional Mormonism and the Mormon community. As this changing social reality within Mormonism alters the options available to Latter-day Saints, it transforms the character of Mormonism itself. The analytical value of this distinction rests on the insight it provides for interpreting and understanding the relationship of people like me to both the church and the community. The light it may shed on the debate over Mormon ethnicity and its implications for an explanation of the current conflict between church officials and Mormon intellectuals. Thank you.
Well, it's a privilege for me to be able to respond to Kendall's paper. I think that he has put his finger very accurately on a number of important issues. First of all, I think he's absolutely right in sociological terms that there are at least two communities operating here. One is the institutional church, and the other one is the much broader Mormon community. I was at a conference in Amsterdam on the visual anthropology last year and met a young woman. We were talking. She was from Kentucky. Turned out that she was a descendant of Heber C. Kimball. Her family hasn't been in the church for two generations, yet they still consider themselves part of the broader Mormon community and consider themselves to have an important heritage there and saw belonging through family networks and institutional ties. And to be honest, it was fascinating for me to sit and talk Mormonese in Amsterdam with someone who for two generations had belonged to a family that wasn't a member of the church. And I could add to those instances with many other examples that time will not permit. But I think that analytically, those of us who look at Mormonism as a focus of scholarship need to decide, are we going to take one of three strategies? Are we going to focus our study on the institutional church? Are we going to focus our studies on the Mormon community? Or are we going to focus on the intersections between those two? Earlier, it was easy to not have to make those decisions. Since, as Kendall wrote wisely, quoting Mario DePillis as well, the community and the church were seen as coterminous. In fact, as I listened to my great aunts, my older relatives, many of whom have passed on now, in fact, it's rather odd to be 38 years old and realize that I already know more people in the cemetery than alive. What happens when you have old polygamous families back there? Anyway, when I listened to them speak when I was a child, when they would speak of the church, it meant community. It did not mean the institutional church. It did not mean sacrament meeting per se. It did not mean testimony and faith per se, although it meant all of those. But its primary reference was to a community that was unified, that involved all of them in a seamless whole. No longer is that true. The word Mormon now means the broader community that is indeed a secular community. With social belonging and social ties. So for those of us who are interested academically, that's an issue that we need to look at. Those of us who are living the experience, however, face a number of existential issues that I couldn't even begin to enumerate because of time. All I want to say is that I think Kendall wisely puts his finger as well on the very personal feelings that many of us have lived, the biography that's written itself in our lives as this social process has worked itself out through us. I'm stunned as a person who's in the middle of the current struggle at the amount of pain and anguish that exists on both sides. I've been surprised, perhaps, at the pain of the administrators at BYU as they've had to deal with issues that really challenge them to within an inch of their selves and their integrity. As they've tried to make understanding of things they don't understand, that don't make sense to them. The pain of seeing a community dividing against itself threatens them. At the same time, they try to reinstitute integrity of boundaries. Kendall said the boundaries are fluid and flexible. They are indeed. And that precisely is one of the problems. I'd like to come to that in a minute. A little bit of criticism of Kendall's paper. He focuses much more on the intellectual Mormon community. Those of us who are interested in intellectual issues and scholarship are rather a rare breed, I'm afraid. We certainly don't represent the majority of the Mormon community. Although we form an important focus, an anchoring point, if you will, intellectuals have their role in society, and that might be thought out carefully for us. But we are not the Mormon community in and of itself. There is also a popular Mormon community. There are other popular magazines and journals like This People. There's also Saturday's Voyeur at the Salt Lake Acting Company that's part of Mormon culture, although it probably angers a lot of Mormons, and so on and so on and so on. That community is much more inchoate, less organized, weaker in some ways. But I wish to stress that when we look at communities, when we look at organizations, we analysts tend to look at institutions as total cultures. We tend to look at the institutions as the things that guarantee the legitimacy of the organization. But we now live in a society here in the United States where no longer are major institutions necessarily the major organizing blocks of society. In fact, one could equally make the point that one would have to look at people who follow the Grateful Dead as a group that anchors, that organizes cultural expression, that brings unity to a culture. In other words, to a feeling of belonging to a social group that takes its meaning and purpose, as well as its social relationships, from participation in the transcendental experience of going to Grateful Dead concerts and listening to the Grateful Dead. That has become an important issue in our society. In other words, no longer is the United States a society that organizes itself along family, kin, region, community, religion. Rather, it organizes itself along many, many things. And the Grateful Dead becomes only one of those. Therefore, things like the Sunstone Symposia and other Mormon gatherings also become important foci of cultural organization and cultural belonging. In terms of the institutional church, it seems to me that the institutional church has suffered a tremendous loss of membership by people of the old families in the last years. As I look at the generation or the group of people that I went to high school with here in Salt Lake, most of the people that I knew then have left the church. I don't know what the rates were in earlier generations. This isn't something that I've studied. And in fact, I'm being very impressionistic instead of giving you accurate figures because I don't know them. But I would like to see someone do a study of loss of membership by the church. And what happens to people when they leave the church? How do they manifest this intense culture and society that we have experienced as Latter-day Saints, as Mormons? Another issue that has evolved here, I'm troubled because it seems to me that the institutional church is more concerned and pleased about its members, often probably Outer Mongolia now for all I know, than it is about those here on the Wasatch Front. It's too willing to look to people who express concerns and issues as expressions of apostasy. Rather than asking, why are so many members of the church leaving? Why are so many people choosing to weaken their ties with Mormonism? The issue doesn't have to do necessarily with strength of testimony, nor does it have to do necessarily with the insidious acts of Satan. Instead, it might very well have to do with the loss of relevance of much of the church's organization, religious practice, to many people's lives. Let me contrast once again. When we live in a world where the Grateful Dead is a very important anchor of transcendence, an anchor of charisma, a very powerful dynamic institution, one has to ask, how does an institution like the Latter-day Saint Church maintain its relevance for its population, and what does it need to do? I'm stunned to notice that less than 50% of this valley we are in right now is Latter-day Saint. Coffee houses abound. They're booming in Salt Lake City. No one would have thought that 10, 15 years ago. Coffee houses abound. I don't think that many people have moved in. To me, that speaks to the loss of the institutional church of much of the Wasatch Front. While I celebrate the growth of the Mormon community, I'm also sad because I'm a seventh-generation Mormon, and the institutional church is very important to me. And I trust that we'll find our way as the institutional church, even as the community grows, and try to maintain some relationship with the broader community so that the day doesn't come when the people come from outside of Utah to come to General Conference, and they come into a city that really is alien turf to the church. I mean, if current trends continue, it wouldn't surprise me 100 years from now to see this valley even be predominantly non, well, it already is predominantly non-member, but 80%, 90% non-Latter-day Saint. See the valley to the south, which has a very high Mormon population, also declining in numbers of members, to where the church becomes an island of domination economically, politically, but not in terms of ideology and membership over this valley. And that saddens me. I hope that day never comes, but I'm afraid it will. Golly, there are lots of other things that I could say about this issue. Kendall really raised, for our discussion, a very rich issue that I think should be the topic of many more symposia and much discussion. But I'd like to speak a little bit to the issues at Brigham Young University since the convener raised them. Oh, they've been raised for so long anyway. Actually, I'm quite tired of it. You know, it's rather an exhausting process. I'd like to say one thing that really troubles me about the debate on all sides is there's been a tendency to want to see things in black and white. If my side is good, the other side is bad. With all kinds of accusations of apostasy, of malfeasance, and so on going back and forth. I honestly believe that on both sides of the issue, the people are really good. They're good people who are honestly struggling with a very hard and very thorny issue. And the issue involves what Kendall said, the collapse of the boundary, clear boundaries of the Mormon community. And furthermore, the development of a neo-fundamentalism within on the part of Mormon authorities. I do not mean polygamy. I mean fundamentalism in the Protestant sense. A holding on to a constriction of certain aspects of Mormonism to certain aspects to which one then holds firm as the fundamentals of the gospel and the major tenets of belief and acceptability within the community. And the major fundamental there that I see, and I see it very clearly in Elder Packer's talk that was reported a few weeks ago in the Tribune, the main fundamental is that of obedience. Obedience to authority. It doesn't matter the issue. What matters is the obedience. It doesn't matter the practice. It doesn't matter the theology, the belief of the person. What matters is the obedience to authority. In other words, I see a Mormonism now that's being circumscribed, being limited, reduced to a belief in obedience. That troubles me historically. It also troubles me because I'm being torn by it. But on the other side, there are a lot of other old and historically valued Mormon practices. I was reading in Henry Eyring the other day, The Faith of a Scientist, that many of you might know. And he speaks that he frequently would tell young people that you really don't have to believe anything to be a Mormon unless it matches what the evidence says. There need be no conflict between science and religion because all we have to do is believe the evidence. But I find myself now in a curious position as a Mormon social scientist teaching at a church school where that no longer follows. Instead, if a general authority decides to say something that runs contradictory to my field of expertise, I'm supposed to be silent, even in the classroom. And if I'm not silent, if I say that the evidence is contrary, then I provoke a crisis of authority and a crisis of belief, ultimately, of testimony. Because I bring into question, first of all, my obedience to the brethren, and secondly, the relevance of authority and the omniscience, if I dare be so bold, of authority, thereby provoking a tremendous crisis of faith on the part of other people. That's a sociological process we can work out. What's sad is that neither side really grants legitimacy to the other side. I'm saddened at the people who do not grant side really grants legitimacy to the other side. I'm saddened at the people who do not grant, do not recognize the historical roots of positions like that of Henry Eyring, of the so-called dissidents or the malcontents at BYU. I don't see dissidents. I don't see malcontents. I see people who have been struggling with faith and are as heartsick and torn about the issues as are the people who are making decisions and ruling on them. We have a community in crisis. But in the crisis, we're also evolving, we're also growing. We stand on the cusp of a divide. None of us knows which path we'll take or where this crisis will lead. None of us knows. I think it's fair to say the Mormon community will keep growing. The institutional church will keep growing. Who's going to belong to which is an open question. What will happen, how they will relate is an open question. But in this, I see quite an evolution. A couple of months ago, there was a rally, a meeting at BYU, to discuss the firing of Cecilia Farr and myself. And quite a number of people were there. One of the most touching things was when the microphone was opened, student after student after student came to the microphone and in tears expressed their difficulties, their frustrations of trying to survive at Brigham Young University. Trying to survive with the constraint of authoritarianism around their hearts and souls. Trying to survive as they crossed, out of necessity, the divide of obedience, which put into conflict their own individual selves versus their testimonies. And conflict as they saw the institution acting in ways that they could make no sense of, nor could they support. One young woman in a speech said, it was Johanna Brooks, as I recall, "We're grown up. Why do they think that they can limit what we're going to see?" Brian Waterman, another student, said, "The people who really damage the testimonies aren't the dissident professors. Rather, it's those who want to keep us from learning, keep us from hearing, keeping us from seeing." And forgive me, Brian, if I misquote you somewhat, but that's the essence of what he said. I was stunned at that meeting at the power, the passion, the energy, the anguish. As an anthropologist, I was also fascinated to see a rhetoric, a style of political protest develop. This deals with, stems right out of the Mormon tradition. Takes Mormon issues, Mormonese, and brings them into a new domain. Freed of the church, to be sure, but a new domain where they take on a new life and start growing socially. I think that's merely the first of many things that will happen over the next few years as we live this historical experience of the growing separation and the growing boundaries between the Mormon institution and the Mormon community. I wish that this were not a process where people would be hurt, where there would not be pain, where there would not be anguish. I'm afraid that there will be martyrs long before this process is over. People have already been hurt. Testimonies have been lost. Commitment has flagged and waned. Relationships have been broken. And the process is just beginning. I can only pray that whether we're part of the whatever ends up being the institutional church, whether we're part of the community, if I can keep the separation, of course Kendall doesn't allow for that, but let me rhetorically make it right now, and I agree with Kendall more than my own rhetoric at this moment, but if we're part of that broader extra-institutional community, or if we stand on the divide, drawn by two steeds that are galloping in opposite directions, may we remember that we're all brothers and sisters. And may there at least be a modicum of love and fellowship and friendship. That we remember our heritage, our common origins, and that we somehow manage to avoid the Cain and Abel syndrome or that of the socialists and communists, namely that you hate the people who are closest to you. Could we please love one another a little more? Thank you.
Gratitude and thanks to our two presenters who have displayed such intellectual honesty and such openness. This is a hallmark of Sunstone and what makes it valuable to all of us, I suppose. We are now have some time available for your questions. There is a microphone here, and you may sit in the chairs there if you wish to. And I'd also like to ask our answerers, our presenters, to just sit at the table, those mics are working, and to restate the question, if they would, before they give us their answers. This is for the tapes, which are for sale, if you don't know, outside in the lobby. Questions, please. Be brave.
My question is, do we, anecdotally and subjectively, I believe that we consider it more difficult to go beyond relationship to the Mormon community than other groups. In other words, it's harder to leave. It's harder to break a tie completely. We feel that link that Dr. Knowlton has talked about of his relative from Virginia or wherever, we think that we experience that much more strongly than other cultures. I'm wondering if you would comment on that.
I think I'll let David comment on the broader cultural sense. Certainly with the familiarity that I would have with primarily other American religions, I think that statement is a legitimate one. One can see similar kinds of conflicts in the experience of Southern fundamentalists though, in relationship to their communities and their detachment.
In some ways, the strength of the commitment, the density of the bonds depends on the intensity of the community's belonging, and also the breadth of the boundaries between our community and the other communities that keep us within it. Also, the overlapping of different social networks on top of one another also help to maintain a very intense experience and make it hard to leave or to break with it. For many people, the experience of being a Latter-day Saint is very strong. I know for myself it's very, very, very strong. And to even contemplate leaving the church, or if such were possible, is almost, it's inconceivable. It's not something that one can even raise as an issue. And a big part of that reason, to be sure, is just the psychological barrier of family and kin, going back generations. You know, when you're raised on the myths and the stories of the crossing the plains from Nauvoo and that famous pogrom, that occurred in Nauvoo, and Utah War and the persecution of people over polygamy, and on and on and on. And when your major social ties are with family members and with other Latter-day Saints, it becomes a very difficult thing to break or to leave, to even consider leaving. But many Latter-day Saints don't feel that. The ward out and about in Virginia, in California, wherever it is not as strong a reproducer as Mormon ethnicity as the old Mormon communities were here on the Wasatch Front. And even here on the Wasatch Front, many people have weaker sense of Mormon belonging than other people. So not for everybody is it going to be the same experience. And I suppose that's okay. But that, again, means that we have to be sympathetic and listen a little bit more to people's experience before we just start immediately jumping to some sort of conclusion. As far as other communities around the globe, ours is weaker than Islam, formal Islam. In fact, I heard a young man in church last Sunday talk about his experience teaching Muslims in Morocco. And he talked about their little branch in Morocco. And I seriously doubt there are many Muslims participating in the branch, because if a person leaves Islam, the broader Islamic community has the right to kill that person as an apostate. Fortunately for us, the Mormon community has yet to invoke that right.
Well, I come from one of these outer Mongolian regions of the church. I'm from southern Ontario, where, as you just noted, the non-institutional connection we feel to the church is a lot weaker. And hence, to be part of the LDS Church, you have to actively participate. Now, we're very sparse. Now, my personal experience with dissent in the church simply resulted with my removal from Sunday school and my assignment to be a nursery assistant, which is considerably less draconian than Dr. White's experience. And I was wondering what your impressions are of the nature of community and institutional control outside of the Utah region. Do you feel, as perhaps I do, that it is somewhat less stringent?
I do think it's less stringent. When you tell the rest of your story there and end up removed from Sunday school teaching, too. See, I would have expected that to have happened much less frequently than the context where my experience was in Mormonism in Salt Lake City at that point. And it seemed to me that often what would happen in wards outside of Mormon domination was there was a lot of, outside of a community with broader Mormon domination, that ward seemed to be somewhat more flexible, and you did at least earlier periods tend to have those kinds of Sunday school classes that got, you might get marginalized in some way, but they were recognized as where the intellectuals gathered or whatever, and they were often associated with university communities in which many of the LDS participants in that were doing graduate work or something. So I think those kinds of situations have made some wards much more flexible. But I don't know, I could join the Stake Sunday School Board and you the nursery. You in Western Ontario and me in Salt Lake City. So the control's there. I suspect the lack of the other kind of Mormon community that I'm talking about is pretty evident unless one's in one of these areas where for some reason there was a fairly substantial grouping of Mormons. I would assume in the D.C. area, for instance, there's a kind of Mormon subculture that's somewhat independent of the institutional church.
If I can be so bold as to jump in, I think these are things we need to study. We don't know what Mormon subcultures really there are around and about. We don't know really what happens in terms of authority outside of Utah. And even here, there's a mixed thing because the existence of a broader Mormon community means that in some way in Utah it's easier to hide and be a nominal Mormon, whereas outside it's not so easy. In some ways, Utah is more open and understanding unless you come to public attention, whereas other wards outside, I've spent about half of my life living in wards outside of Utah. I was raised outside of Utah, moved here as a teenager, never got over the culture shock. In some ways, the wards outside of Utah are more authoritarian, more demanding, but on certain issues, certain kinds of things. And instead of falling into this dichotomization, we need to start breaking this down into subsets and sub-issues so that we can do a finer-grained analysis and get a sense of the diversity of Mormonisms. I mean, I'm convinced that there are multiple Mormonisms within the institutional church, not to mention the Mormon community as a broader group right now.
Professor White, your very interesting account, I think, invites the inference that it's the policies of the institutional church which have exacerbated the split between the institution and the larger Mormon community. These policies of that you've described as repressive, authoritarian, and so on. What exactly would the institutional church have to do to try to reduce that split? Ought it, for instance, start with the doctrine of sustaining the authorities and amend that? And if so, concretely and specifically, how? I'm looking for your suggestions from both you and Professor Knowlton about precisely what steps the institution ought to take to try to change the current situation.
David pointed out the return to a preoccupation I'm not altogether familiar with. In fact, I'm not familiar with the speech of Elder Packer that you were referring to, but the theme resonates, that is returning to the focus on obedience. And I think throughout Mormon history, there's been a real tension between the way in which one would express one's loyalty and commitment to the community through some display of obedience, and this is a cardinal kind of demand, and on the other hand, the theological foundations of Mormonism that underscore the development of individual autonomy and intellect and so on. So those are both part of the tradition. It seems to me that the sustaining issue would be precisely one where the problem could be addressed, and that is to come to some sort of understanding of principle of sustaining that acknowledges a loyalty in some way to Mormonism in a general sense, but this has been used for very narrow agendas. So it seems to me that it has to mean something other than simply obedience to some ambiguous
I was asking either. For a very specific recommendation. For instance, would you urge that, say, the general authorities or some other party issue a statement, for example, asserting that sustaining doesn't require unanimous assent? Or what?
Well, I think it would be easy to draw on the tradition.
Because it's easiest to make change if a concrete step is identified.
I mean, there are certainly historical examples where people dissented and voted differently and so on. The sustaining vote has become a perfunctory act of, it isn't a vote, it's a perfunctory ritual. And I think it has to be separated from obedience used in a kind of ideological sense where it isn't even identification of obedience to principles. It's used in each case in a way in which one can deal with the question of whether somebody should be descending over anything from the issues that I described, women's issues to number. But I wouldn't expect that to happen. I mean, that's advising general authorities to redefine and relinquish a kind of control that they enjoy. Did you want to comment on that?
Really briefly, if I can just make two quick points. First of all, although you asked the question, I'm sure, out of great sincerity and honesty, let me point out that is one of the real tripwires in the debate right now. The Brethren find it very difficult and dangerous when we start making specific suggestions to them as to what they should do, and makes it hard to answer the question. Secondly, well, it's also hard politically because you don't know how you can ever implement it. But secondly, the problems we're having in the church right now are really a function of size, in my opinion. If you have 8 million members, you're going to have a complex social organization, and you're going to have a fair amount of diversity. The more number of human beings you have together, I mean, this is like the old game of the telephone, you know, where you whisper in people's ear, and they pass it on, it gets confused and complex. We're going to have to decide as a community how we're going to maintain unity in the face of ever-developing complexity. I mean, the institutional church is going to have to decide that. I'm not sure I can tell them what they're going to need to do politically, but it's a decision they're going to have to make. And it's a very troublesome one because it's going to mean challenging that old unity that they would like to return to.
It's time for the session to conclude. We thank you for your participation, for your questions. This is a subject of great interest, and I'm sure that will be taken up further in further Sunstone symposiums.